Hello and good afternoon. Welcome to the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta's Talk About Payments webinar, Are Mobile Payments Safe? I'm Meredith Elmore from the Center for Learning and Innovation, and I will be your moderator for today's call. Today, we are joined by David Lott, payments risk expert from the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta. Before we get started, I do want to cover a few logistics that can be found on slide two. If you have not had a chance to join us in the webinar, please click on the link provided to you in your webinar invitation. Please note that this call is being recorded and everyone's phone lines have been muted. I did also want to cover some brief legal information. The views expressed in the presentation are from the presenters and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta or the Federal Reserve System. We will be pausing for questions at a few points during today's conversation. You can ask your question at any time by emailing us at rapid@stls.frb.org, or you can click the Ask Question button located in the bottom left-hand corner of your webinar. And at this time, I will turn the call over to David to get us started.
Thank you so much, Meredith. Appreciate everyone's participation in our initial Talk About Payments webinar, where we're going to discuss the question of, are mobile payments safe? Before we get started, if we could move to slide three, let me give you a little bit of background with regard to the Retail Payments Risk Forum. And as I'm going through that, we have a polling question that we want you to ask. It should pop up on your screen in just a minute. The question is, relative to other payment methods, how safe are mobile payments? Very safe, generally safe, but you have some concerns, somewhat unsafe, or not at all safe. We'll give you a little bit of time to answer those questions, and we'll see the results in just a little bit. But let me give you a short commercial with regard to the group that I work in here at the Atlanta Fed, the Retail Payments Risk Forum. We serve as a research and educational group for the entire payments industry. We do that in several ways, through white papers, through events such as this webinar, our weekly blog. We often speak at industry events as well as host events here at the Atlanta Bank. Our weekly blog, Take on Payments, you'll see the link there that if you don't already subscribe, we hope that you will do so. All the information that we produce is public information and can be found on our webpage on the Atlanta Fed site. And again, the link is there on this page so that you'll can refer to that. I mentioned convening other groups, and one such group that you can see on slide number four is the Mobile Payments Industry Work Group, or the MPIW. This is a group that was formed as a joint effort of the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston and the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta back in 2009, held their first meeting in 2010, and meet two or three times a year between the two banks. You can see on the slide four the types of members that we have, around 45 or 50 members, and from a wide variety of all the payment system stakeholders. And the Federal Reserve acts as a facilitator of that group. The membership is the one that drives the agenda for the group as well as the work efforts of that group. So, Meredith, I'm not seeing the slide advance here. Are we good on your end? Oh, there we go. Okay, it's advanced. So, and I'll be talking about the effort of that group with regard specifically to mobile security and a paper that was produced out of that group, of which a lot of this content is developed. So you can go to the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, simply Google FRB Boston MPIW, and that will take you to the web page that, again, has all of the deliverables that come out of that group available for you for your reading. How are we doing on the results of the polling question, Meredith?
I am pushing out those results right now.
Okay. 19 say very safe. Almost three-quarters of you are saying generally safe, and 8% somewhat. Nobody believes that it's not at all safe. Very interesting, and we're going to ask this question again towards the at the end of the webinar to see if we've been successful in changing your mind through any of the information that we've given you here. Very interestingly, the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, Atlanta, and five other districts did a survey back last year of mobile banking and payment services of the financial institutions in their districts. We had about 700 respondents, and interestingly, 94% of them felt that mobile payments were safer than other forms of payments. So I can see we have a little bit of convincing to do here. If we could jump to slide number five to cover what we're going to talk about here today. First of all, I wanted to cover the mobile landscape that exists in the United States today, then talk about the benefits as well as the risks of mobile payments. And then we'll talk about consumer security behaviors, because certainly consumers are a vital link in the overall transaction process, and there are security issues associated with how consumers treat and use their mobile phones. And then we'll kind of start to wind it up with a discussion that came out of the MPIW with regard to the best practices for mobile security. So jumping to slide six, talking about the overall landscape, certainly mobile phones have become a key driver in the payments spectrum here in the United States. I love this picture, you know, showing the proliferation of mobile phones throughout the world, but certainly, you know, very strong penetration here in the United States. From work that the Board of Governors have done through the Consumer and Financial Services report that they do each year, 87% of U.S. adults have a mobile phone, and that number has remained pretty steady for the last several years. Of that, 77% of the total adults have a smartphone, and that number certainly has been increasing. People that originally started off with analog phones or the older phones as their contracts expired, they have upgraded to the smartphone. So having increasing penetration in that area. On the next slide, we'll see how those phones are being used with regard to driving the increase in e-commerce volume. Overall, e-commerce is around $350 billion in 2016, which represented between 8 and 9% of total retail sales. As you can see on the breakdown, you know, here, the share of mobile as part of that e-commerce has continued to increase, especially over the last 2 years from 2014 to 2016, where in 2016 it was estimated to be about 20% of the total of e-commerce. And Meredith, I see we already have a question about this slide.
Yes, we do. So according to the slide, desktops still dominate the overall share of e-commerce transactions. How and why do you see that changing?
Great question. Certainly, you know, e-commerce started out with the desktop, and that still, as this slide show, represents the majority of device being used to conduct that e-commerce transaction. Some transactions really lend themselves to the wider screen. What I have seen in other consumer research is that items such as jewelry and clothing, things of that nature, people like to have more detail with regard that simply isn't available on the mobile phone due to the limited size of the screen, although the screens on the mobile phone certainly have increased over the years. Whereas transactions such as digital goods, music, backgrounds, things of that nature, games, lend themselves very easily to the mobile phone. So I think that we'll continue to see that share of the mobile device increasing over time. Let's jump to the next slide. People think of mobile wallets as a relatively new item in the United States, but the reality is that they've been around for over a decade. Back in the mid to late 2000s, you had the first mobile wallets come up with PayPal and Apple. You had contactless cards, which had, in essence, wallets on that card through Visa and MasterCard through their NFC cards. You had proprietary merchant wallets come up with Starbucks in 2011, and then that has progressed to where we are now. Certainly the introduction of Apple Pay in the fall of 2014 was a major event with the proliferation of mobile wallets, as that was very quickly followed by Samsung Pay and other pay wallets. Google Pay, as well as some of the large merchants, Walmart, WalPay, the Currency Merchant Consortium effort started in that period of time. So if we jump to the next slide, we kind of see, you know, why all this activity has taken place here, and that there are tremendous advantages with mobile payments over other types of payments. The mobile phone device provides some additional security, and I think that is a large reason why people view the transaction as more secure. In that the phones have the Touch ID in the case of Apple, or fingerprint sensors in the others. The new Apple phone is coming out with some very innovative facial recognition capability. All the phones have microphones for voice recognition. So there's tremendous ability for both merchants as well as financial institutions to have that additional data in order to authenticate the customer in that regard. Many merchants believe that mobile payments are more efficient than card payments or cash or check payments, and so throughput of customers is always a critical issue, and so that's a major advantage for them. We read reports all the time with regard to the millennial adoption of mobile phones, how they've could be surgically implanted in many people's case. It's become a critical part of their lifestyle. And so the merchant community has reacted to that in order to provide that strong positive customer experience. Again, the phone provides some capabilities because of that GPS geolocation capability of being able to send couponing and other type of incentives based upon where you are if a customer opts in for those types of services, as well as to integrate into the applications such as Starbucks has done, loyalty applications of buy so many cups of coffee and get the next one free, or different types of incentives in that regard. An issue that's very important to the Federal Reserve System is financial inclusion. We certainly have seen that in other countries where mobile phone and payment capability has leapfrogged and provided financial services to many consumers that previously were out of reach of the financial system in that regard. If you ask merchants why they're supporting mobile payments, 85% indicated that because customers want that, they see it as a convenience for that, and 61% indicated that they believe that customers expect to have that capability of payment, it's the type of payment that they want to use. So jumping over to the next slide, number 10, the environment is not one that's static. It is changing very rapidly. There's lots of new technologies. I mentioned just a minute ago about the enhanced facial recognition that is coming out with the new iPhone, different pay models, different players in the game, and we're going to talk about some of those payment models here in just a minute. We have a lot of non-financial institutions participating. I mentioned that, you know, PayPal and Google were players, you know, back 10 years ago, and they certainly are major players now, joined by others such as Amazon. In the retail banking world, you know, the term omnichannel is a predominant one of trying to provide a very strong, positive customer experience, no matter what type of delivery channel they're using, whether they're in the branch or they're mobile or they're talking to the call center, for whoever is dealing with that customer to have complete knowledge about that customer and what they're doing. But having that omni-channel capability poses some additional payment security risks of making sure all the different channels talk to one another and not creating additional security gaps. And as the examiners have said, you know, over the last several years, you know, the need for multi-layered security. Can't emphasize this enough, that there is no single security tool or methodology that is 100% foolproof. But when you start layering additional security methods, tools on top of each other, it certainly does diminish that risk. And as we have talked about in other venues, the faster payments, real-time payment that we've seen happen in other countries, particularly the UK, Australia, now coming to the United States, they are a reality, and so does faster payments mean faster fraud? I think everyone agrees that the security game needs to be increased in order to address faster payments. So jumping to the next slide, the mobile payment transaction certainly creates additional risk because there are different and new parties in the process. We mentioned the different stakeholders in the mobile payments outside of just financial institutions and merchant. In a card transaction, you basically had the issuer, the merchant, and then the card network, whereas in the mobile payments, you may have the mobile network operator, you have other third parties involved in there. Because it's a remote transaction, you have additional customer authentication issues. It just becomes a more complex and additional challenges there. As we show in the next slide here, in terms of, you have the pay wallets, and again we'll talk about those in more detail in a few minutes. But then you have the merchant wallets, and so how are they going to interact with the financial institutions? Merchants are very concerned about protecting their customers' information and their transaction activity, but at the same time, issuers want to make sure that they are approving legitimate transactions. You have payment service providers that are helping facilitate those transactions. Customers, you know, tremendous amount of transaction volume going through PayPal and Amazon with their one-click capability that either maintain a prepaid account that is funded through a financial institution account, and then the one-click services that use a card on file, things of that nature. And then you have financial institutions. Some of the larger financial institutions are developing their own wallets, whereas others are using third parties as well. So jumping over to slide, where we be at 13, I guess we will be. We can't talk about the payment landscape without talking about chip card migration. The important thing to remember here is that chip card migration does not address card-not-present fraud. In fact, it only makes it worse. You look at the graphs here showing the experience of other countries that have already gone through chip card migration, and you can see that after they largely migrated over to chip cards, the rate of card-not-present fraud has continued to increase. We know criminals always look for the weak targets, weakest link in the chain. And as the chip cards, you know, have hardened that target, particularly, you know, at the POS, the criminals aren't retiring. They're simply saying, okay, where can I go next? And the card-not-present space of being able to do transactions online is a key target of that. And we've seen that in other countries, and we've seen that in the United States in the limited amount of time that we've had that migration. And I see we've had a question pop up with regard to this slide.
Yes, we do. So has the chip migration been successful?
Great question. Yes, I would say it has. It's important to remember that the goal of the chip card was to reduce, if not pretty much eliminate, counterfeit card fraud at the point of sale. It was never intended to address card-not-present transactions. And it's been very successful so far. The card networks are reporting anywhere from 50 to 70% reductions in card-present fraud, where the transaction between a chip card and a terminal that is chip-enabled is taking place. There are still some issuers that have not completed their migration. There's still a number of merchants that have not upgraded their terminals or turned on the terminals to accept chip cards. And they're starting to see the impact of that because of the liability shift, and that if a merchant doesn't upgrade the terminal and it is a chip card, then they become liable for that card-present transaction, whereas previously it was the card issuer. You know, again, the comment with regard to the criminals not going away, they always look for the weak target, whereas the large retailers have generally shifted over to chip terminals, so now the criminals are going after mid-size and small retailers who still are using the mag stripe because that's where they can use those counterfeit cards that they've obtained that card information through data breaches and other information. So looking at slide 14, let's talk about card not present or mobile payments fraud a little bit more detail. LexisNexis did a study in 2016 that based on their study of merchants, they pegged overall fraud losses of just under 1.5% of sales volume. But the interesting thing in that third sub-bullet is that even though mobile transactions represented 14% of the overall merchant transactions, fraudulent mobile transactions represented 21% of the merchant's fraudulent transactions. So even though the criminal set has largely not ignored, but have used other channels for their fraudulent activity, as mobile payment activity has increased, it's become more and more of a target, and we're seeing that in the statistics. And so what are merchants doing? The large merchants involved in mobile commerce, they're employing additional tools in order to help authenticate that customer to make sure as much as they can without creating a negative experience that is a legitimate customer. Many of them have put in risk-based systems that look at transaction activity, look at previous activity of that customer. If they have some, is this the typical transaction this customer does, or is it so far out of their profile that it really demands some additional checking? And as I mentioned earlier on in the presentation, additional information that provided by the phone, particularly with regard to geolocation and other data elements of the phone, that the merchant can kind of make sure that, okay, this says that this customer lives in Nashville, Tennessee, but the phone right now is somewhere in Eastern Europe. Does that make any sense? Certainly there could be a legitimate explanation, but given the amount of fraudulent transactions that take place in certain locations, it's one that demands some further exploration by the merchant to make sure it's not a fraudulent transaction. So jumping to the next slide, with all of this background and seeing the increase in payment fraud on the mobile side, the MPIW group identified the need to take a closer look at the different types of mobile payment fraud and what tools could be done, what is the risk level for each of these use cases that were developed. So the group identified four major use cases with regard to mobile payments that you see listed on this slide. First, you have the pay wallets, Apple Pay, Android Pay, Samsung Pay. The second group was what we call the cloud-based wallets or card-on-file wallets. PayPal, Amazon Pay are key examples of that group. You also have proprietary wallets as well, different merchants there. Third group was the card network digital wallets. Each of the major card brands have their different checkout capabilities that a merchant can integrate into their checkout page. And then to serve as a baseline, the fourth group that we identified that really isn't a mobile wallet as such is that where a guest goes through a checkout process either through the mobile browser or the application and enters their payment information rather than it already being on file or already being stored in the device. So those were the four use cases that we looked at. And going to slide number 16, we then broke down the transaction sequence with regard to mobile payments and the wallets and looked at those separately to identify the types of attacks that you see at the bottom of slide could take place in each of those five areas. The first area was account creation. There we're not talking about opening DDA account or deposit account, but creating the account with the merchant. Setting up user ID, password, or whatever authentication capability is required to set up that account. The second part is when entering payment credentials, if that use case required such. How do you verify that those payment credentials being entered in are legitimate payment credentials that are tied to that legitimate user and not fraudulent activity? And then the third group is once you move over to the actual transaction itself, again, what authentication tools are being used, what type of attacks can take place to spoof the identity of the legitimate user and have the criminal conduct those transactions instead. And then we also looked at the integration of the mobile phone itself or the mobile device, the operating system being used in those devices or in the cloud to see what type of attacks could occur there. And then the role of third parties. As the financial institutions are very much aware, examiners have been sensitive to the use of all types of third parties for financial institutions in their examinations, and certainly mobile payments is not exempt from that regard. Moving over to the next slide, we'll talk about each of those four use cases at a high level. Again, there's a paper published that goes into detail on each of these items, so I'm only going to cover the key takeaways from each of those. But that first use case, again, are the pay wallets. The real distinguishing factor with regard to the pay wallets is the use of payment tokens. That is, when the consumer enters their payment credentials into that wallet for the first time, the issuer has the ability to authenticate not only that account number, but also to authenticate the customer. And that's the most critical aspect of that enrollment transaction, because if you enroll the criminal, you know what's going to happen. You're only going to get fraudulent transactions. And so the wallets have developed this capability, identification and verification, to try and eliminate that type of fraud. But also with this token is that once that payment credential has been entered in and approved by the issuer, what comes back to the phone is not the primary account number of that payment card, but instead a token. It's a random number. It looks like a typical credit card number, but it's completely random. There's also a dynamic cryptogram included in the transaction sequence that is unique to that transaction. So even if the criminal intercepts the transaction during the processing and attempts to accumulate those and replay them under a false merchant terminal, they're all going to be rejected because that cryptogram will not pass because it is unique to the time and the transaction there. Jumping over to the next slide, 18, For all of those reasons, the tokenization, the cryptogram, the identification and verification, the MPIW assigned a low probability of risk to the fraud attacks and threats there. Because the application is stored in a very secure area of the phone, the different vendors have different ways of securing that, but it is a very highly secure area of the phone that really is tamper-proof to the common folks, and for that reason, very low fraud has been incurred on that. And then on the transaction side, again, because of Touch ID or fingerprint sensors, which many customers are using, you have that biometric capability instead of a password, but that password is capability. And many issuers who are supporting these wallets have given their customers the capability that should that phone be lost or stolen, they can contact the issuer and immediately shut down that phone from doing other transactions. So, you know, again, a host of security features have been built into and processes set up to make these very safe and secure. So to the overall question, are mobile payments safe? Our response is that the pay wallets represent a very, very safe method of payment. Jumping to slide number 19, the second use case talks about the cloud-based card-on-file models. Again, PayPal and Amazon are some of the leading participants in that, as well as there's a number of large retailers that have such capabilities, is that you set up the account, you enter the payment credential, and they keep that information on file. Some of those large retailers are in discussions with the card networks to develop a similar tokenization capability to protect that information, but those that you know, aren't dealing necessarily with the card networks, they have developed their own internal tokenization so that when that information is at rest, it is protected. Either it's encrypted or there's a true security tokenization process in place so that should there be a data breach, the payment information in the clear is not available to the hacker in that regard. Jumping to slide 20, the overall assessment by the MPIW is that they rated that actually there was a medium to high probability of risk related to the account creation there, is that because the customer is setting that account up using there's just that capability due to account takeover fraud, things of that nature of getting that primary account number information through other data hacks, things of that nature, and they create those accounts. So again, it's up to the merchants who are using these type of wallets to develop very sophisticated risk engines. And I can tell you that the two merchants that I named there, Amazon and PayPal, have very sophisticated risk engines that they're using to look at the transaction activity when a customer is making a checkout request, and using a variety of tools in order to confirm that capability without creating too much friction in that customer experience. And then, you know, if they suspect something is suspicious, a lot of times they will go ahead and accept the transaction, but in the background do some additional research to validate that. Looking at the next slide, 2021, I guess that will be. The third use case is the card network digital wallets. This is a relatively new development in how they are being used. If you recall back on that graph, Visa and MasterCard came out with a form of digital wallets through their contactless cards back some time ago. But over the last couple years, they have made this checkout capability available to merchants, to whereby the merchant adds the logo, if you will, as a checkout option on their screen, and if the customer selects that, then the transaction goes outside of the merchant to the issuer through that card brand in order to validate that transaction. So the merchant never sees the card number, the payment information in that regard. And so for that reason, the MPIW assigned a low to medium probability of risk. There's still that issue associated with customer account takeover and trying to initiate fraudulent transactions in that regard, but because the merchant never sees payment information itself, the payment credentials, it reduces the overall fraud risk level in that regard. The next slide is the fourth guest checkout method that the MPIW looked at, and that's where there is no card on file. It's where the customer simply goes to the merchant website or through their mobile app. They have not previously given them any payment credentials, but if they purchase merchandise, they are then entering card number, card security code, probably their billing address, all of that information necessary that normally could be previously stored if they had agreed to do that. About two-thirds of the top 100 retailers offer guest checkout. You look at the consumer research as to why certain consumers prefer this over having the information stored, is they primarily are concerned for privacy and security reasons of having that. Perhaps they don't understand the security processes that take place, particularly with the larger merchants in the background for storage of that information in a secure way. They read about all the data breaches of merchants and other parties, and they just don't want that information at risk in that regard. Overall, the MPIW assess this as a medium to a high probability of risk, simply because the merchant doesn't have previous information about this customer. They're seeing them for perhaps the first time, certainly with regard to payment transaction. Now, the customer may have done transactions in the past, and some merchants try and record that through other means, but many do not, so that there is that risk associated there. So finally, jumping over to slide 23, you know, what we have seen in these different use cases is a number of security controls and methods. We talked about tokenization both on the payment side with the pay wallets, security tokenization, which relates to the merchants and data at risk of how they protect that payment card, personal information, how they're supposed to be protecting that information. And then if they're not using tokenization, encryption, usually during the transaction process itself, as that transaction authorization message passes from one party to another, that is an encrypted form. So if somebody does intercept that, it makes it more difficult for them to pull out the legitimate payment information. We also talked about cryptograms associated with the pay wallets, and also with EMV cards, although EMV cards are not being used in the mobile payments, other than, in essence, the chip in the mobile phones is very similar to the chip on a card. And the fact that both issuers and merchants are using risk-based mitigation tools in order to first authenticate the individual and their payment credentials to make sure that what is being loaded into the wallets or being put on file does belong to that customer, to avoid fraudulent transactions in the future, and to make sure that once they do transactions, that is the legitimate customer that is making those transactions. So let me pause here for just a minute and see what we have. Meredith, have we got some additional questions? Looks like we do.
Yes, we do, David. So I'm just going to start here at the top of the list for what we have right now. Is a chip card really successful without a PIN?
Great question, and it's really two separate issues in that the PIN has nothing to do with the counterfeit card aspect of the chip, which is what the chip was intended to do. If you utilize a PIN, that protects against lost stolen fraud, in that if I lose my chip card and the merchant doesn't require a PIN, then that fraudster can still, you know, use the card at the POS and conduct a transaction, because the verification is signature for larger amount transactions, where if they required a PIN, that card could not be used. A lot of question and discussion in the industry with regard to, you know, should the EMV migration have required PINs? A lot of reasons why that didn't take place. Certainly, PINs are used by consumers on debit cards if they use ATMs, because the ATMs require PINs. But credit cards in the United States have really never been used unless the person was using that credit card at an ATM where they needed that for verification, or they were traveling internationally where PIN usage is required in many countries. And again, you have to look at the dynamics of those countries to understand that, and that many of the European countries, and this goes to often the question of why was the United States so late to adopt chip cards when France did it, you know, 20 years ago, is that the payment infrastructure was very different. Pretty much ever since the beginning of cards, 99%, 99.9%, I think, today, of card transactions are authorized online. Whereas in Europe and many of the countries there in Europe, because of expensive telecommunications, unreliable telecommunications, they had to support offline transactions. And so because there wasn't that online verification and authorization, that's why PIN was often put into place there. Counterfeit card fraud was the most predominant amount of fraud prior to chip. Lost stolen fraud was a very small incremental part of that. You know, personal opinion, I think that you will see PIN at some point in time in the future, but I don't see it immediately here. Let me jump real quickly, if we could, to slide 25, talking about consumer issues associated with payments, because I think that's important. And it also demonstrates some questions with regard to when consumers say one thing, do they really follow up with their actions in that regard? And this slide, to me, demonstrates one of those conflicts, and that the question was asked in the 2016 Consumer and Financial Services Survey conducted by the board of, you know, what is your primary concern of mobile payments? And more than a third basically said anything and everything that was on the list. But if you look at the second item, my phone getting hacked or someone intercepting my data, you know, a quarter of the people indicated that was a very strong concern. But then you look at down at the bottom where that second arrow is of having malware or viruses being installed on their phone, you know, the reality is we have seen consumer behavior, and there's some subsequent slide that shows, you know, they don't lock their phone. They click on suspicious websites offering free games, things of that nature that end up having the malware and viruses being installed on their Android phones. And so they're kind of creating that atmosphere for their phone getting hacked. So a little bit of a discrepancy there in customer reaction and action that we as an industry have to address through education. Let's jump through these next slides quickly. If we can jump to 26. Again, this presentation will be made available to you as well as a recording of the webinar shortly afterwards, so you can go back and look at this detail. This asked the question by the Pew Research Center in 2016 with regard to what steps are consumers taking with regard to trying to secure their phone. Under a quarter of them indicated that they are using screen lock and they are updating their apps and operating systems as quickly as they can. Three quarters of them indicated that, you know, they're using screen lock sometimes and they're updating their apps and operating system, but there may be a delay in such activity there. They're not doing it as quickly as they could, which, of course, without updating those patches and upgrades, then that can expose some gaps and security risk there. Jumping to the next slide, they use a variety of options in securing their mobile device. You know, the thumbprint or fingerprint sensor has been wildly popular with consumers in lieu of a passcode or some type of swipe there. Although this research showed about an even distribution between using a PIN or passcode and their fingerprint sensor. But I think that as you see more and more applications supporting the fingerprint sensor, that number will increase. Jump into slide 28. Biometrics. We could do a whole session and probably will at some point in time on the future biometrics because it's of great interest, not only in the mobile payment space, but in the overall transaction customer authentication space. Again, I mentioned fingerprint has been very popular with customers. Two-thirds indicated that they're very comfortable with that regard. Eye scans a little bit less so, although I think eye scans here has been interpreted to be facial recognition when in fact facial recognition and iris recognition are two very different things. The new Samsung Note 8 is capable of doing iris recognition, and we talked about the new iPhone coming out with facial recognition capability as well. And I think we've got a question about this slide specifically.
Yes, we do, David. Which biometric is the best?
Oh, that's the $64,000 question there. And my answer is, there is not a one-size-fits-all with regard to biometrics. Each biometric, you have to look at the application, how it's being used. Certainly some biometrics, are more advanced than others in the marketplace, and their reliability, their adaptability is different, so you have to look at that. But fingerprint certainly is the leading candidate. We're seeing a new category not even shown here, and that's behavioral biometrics that has emerged over the last year as being used by a lot of online retailers that tracks the customer's use, whether it be through a phone or a desktop or a tablet, with regard to screen navigation, the pressure they put on keys. Supposedly they can tell, in the case of mobile phone, whether the person is left-handed or right-handed, things of that nature. Just amazing technology there, but it's going to continue to evolve, get more reliable, get less expensive, so I think that there's going to be a huge increase in biometric capability for financial institutions and merchants to be able to utilize that as a security tool there. So, jump into the next slide here, if I'm not losing my place. Some key takeaways for the mobile payments. Overall, mobile payments certainly have the potential to be extremely secure. But in and of itself, you need additional tools and monitoring because there's no single solution that is bulletproof there. Certainly mobile, with the capabilities of tokenization, things of that nature, have made a big step forward with regard to that capability. But one particular modality of biometrics or one particular security tool is not sufficient in and of itself. You have to use that multi-factor capability to provide that strength there. Jumping to the next slide, education. We have constantly said through our blogs and such, there can never be too much education for not only consumers, but other stakeholders. We have seen in the EMV space a real shallow level of education of merchants, small business merchants, with regard to chip migration, and if they're moving into the mobile space, the risks that they are looking at there. So education is something that we constantly are looking at doing. Meredith, if we could jump over a couple of slides, because we're running short on time, to 35, slide 35. You know, again, I talked about multi-factor, and we're seeing both merchants and financial institutions, they're using multiple security controls, because there's not a one-size-fits-all. There are new tools that are coming into the market, such as 3D Secure 2.0, that there's an earlier slide talking about that. We'll see how that plays in the marketplace. Certainly from a security potential standpoint, it's a big improvement, but the adoption rate by merchants and issuers, as well as the pricing, is going to dictate how much that's being used. And on the next slide, with regard to the FIs, again, banks and credit unions, they're using multiple security tools. You have to do that in order to address the wide range of threats that are coming in. So with that, we've only got a couple of minutes left. We wanted to ask the polling question again, if we could bring that up, Let's see if we've been able to change anybody's mind. Okay, so you've got the polling question up again. If you could take in the next couple of seconds to answer that, and then we'll get the information. Do we have time for another question, Meredith, while we're waiting for the polling to be finished?
Yes, I think we can get in one more question here before we run out of time. So while you're taking that opportunity to respond to that poll question, I have this question that came in for you, David. When you categorized the risks, which party's perspective was most considered for that?
All of the parties were considered. It was the overall assessment of the MPIW in the sense of, if you go back to that slide when you're looking at the deck, we pretty much have representation of all of the stakeholders in the mobile payments space, with possibly the exception of the consumer advocacy groups. But certainly merchants, processors, chip manufacturers, financial institutions all had to say. It was a smaller group composed of representatives of each of that group that actually wrote the paper, wrote the sections of the paper, but the paper was sent out to all of the MPIW members for comment and questions, and so that overall risk assessment was representative of the entire membership. So there was not one particular perspective relating to that. So have we got the results? Let's see. Well, about the same. We didn't change anybody's mind. Matter of fact, the very safe went down a little bit, and I certainly didn't do my job very well. Now we've got somebody saying not at all safe in that regard. So very, very interesting, but most indicated three-quarters almost generally safe, but some concerns, which is what I really expected in that regard. I want to thank everybody again for your participation. You will be receiving a survey with regard asking you to give your candid feedback on this webinar. As we indicated, this is the first of what we hope will be many in the future. We're going to try and do those once a quarter. We know your time is valuable, so we appreciate that feedback. And we also want to know what topics would you like for us to cover in the future that are of greatest interest to you as we continue to provide additional education. So, Meredith, I will turn it over to you for any closing comments.
Well, thank you so much, David, and I just want to thank everyone also for joining today's call. I hope you got a lot out of it, and thank you to David for also all of his hard work on today's session. This concludes today's call. Have a great day, everyone.